The opinions expressed on Inside the Black Box do not reflect those of WREK Radio or the Georgia Institute of Technology. Welcome to Inside the Black Box, a weekly program on science and technology, or as we like to think of it, science only funnier. I'm Pete Ludovis, and as always, I'm joined by my ever effervescent co-host, a man who believes the solar wind has something to do with eating at Taco Bell, Bill Hunt. I was just ad-libbing that, too. I didn't really have a good one today.
Well, yeah, I was in New Mexico the last few days, so there's red chili, green chili, and then there's the odorous stuff coming from the table.
So, you know, being a well-respected member of the scientific and engineering community, you had to start with the cheap sophomoric bathroom humor jokes.
You did. You started it.
Well, I alluded to it in an ever so professional way.
Okay, sorry.
All right, so today's show, ladies and gentlemen, is entitled Weapons-Grade Allegations, which happens to be the title of a piece that appeared in The Chemical Engineer, a British publication by ICHEME, the Institute of Chemical Engineering, some time ago, that details some potential issues we have at the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, made by Dr. Dan Tedder, who's our guest today. Dr. Tedder actually spent many, many years here on the faculty of Chemical and Biomolecular Engineering at Georgia Tech, correct? Before that, you were actually involved in, was it Oak Ridge Lab?
Yes, Oak Ridge National Laboratory, right. I was in the Chemical Technology Division there.
Right, so you were doing sort of nuclear-related stuff then?
Yes, I was working on actinide partitioning flow sheets, which is a form of reprocessing.
So actinide, that would be that nasty series that hangs off the edge of the periodic table on the
bottom. Bottom row, yeah.
Right.
That's exactly. Actually useful for something?
Yes, that's what nuclear power is based on.
Actinide?
No, actinides.
No. Yeah, actinium is the first one in the actinide series, right? And what's the other one below it?
The lanthanide series.
Yeah.
Okay.
So these are all the really big, fat, heavy elements that aren't quite as stable as things like iron and will tend to break in half. And that's what fission is, right?
Yeah. Right, absolutely.
Okay. So then after his career here at Georgia Tech, he actually went back to work for the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, correct?
That is correct.
Right.
I was hired in as an independent reviewer to look at what's called the MOX facility. It's a facility being constructed in Aiken, South Carolina, where they will take plutonium warheads, convert into the oxide, and then send the oxide through a chemical purification process to separate out the americium from the plutonium, which is then, and the plutonium is then, after being purified, is mixed with uranium oxide to form a mixed oxide pellet, which can then be inserted into a nuclear power reactor.
So you're taking the plutonium out of thermonuclear weapons and changing it into fuel for nuclear reactors?
That is correct.
Wow, so even a liberal like Bill would be excited about that, right, Bill?
I'm not a liberal.
Oh, I see. You spent the entire 2008 year bashing Bush, but you're saying you're not a liberal?
That's on common sense.
Okay, all right, I'll give you that.
It's just classic weapons to plowshares.
Wow, I think that's great. So before we get into the details of that and potential issues at the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, let's start, as we often do, with science in the news. Now, Bill, you've got a couple interesting articles, right?
Right. So again, from the International Herald Tribune, this is dated January 14th. A love vaccine might be just the thing. So neuroscientist Larry Young has offers a grand unified theory of love, analyzing brain chemistry of mammalian pair bonding.
Wait, a unified theory, not of physics, not of the standard model of particle physics, but love.
I think we need some Motown music in the background on this.
Unified theory of love.
Yeah. So, but just sort of getting more to the details of brain chemistry and speculation here on the part of the reporter is that the pharmaceutical companies could get some of this, sneak it into your drink. And there have been love. not your drink.
Okay.
But nobody.
Because no one would endeavor to do that.
Nobody would want that.
Not even my wife, I'm thinking.
I don't think so. This has been around for centuries, right? Love potions and the whole deal. But this is just more science behind the brain chemistry of why you spend so much time watching Britney Spears videos, for example.
No, she doesn't float my boat.
Okay,
She's just a bad example of, I don't know.
Trailer trash.
I'm not going to go there.
Trailer trash.
Yeah, you always with the colorful, insulting, and narrow-minded characterization.
That's why they pay me the big bucks.
All right, you got anything actually interesting over there?
Well, no, not really. This one is that, be ready to stop the presses. Sleep may be the best cure for the common cold.
I believe duh would be the technical word that's most appropriate here.
So.
All right, let me turn to something a little more timely. This is from a while back, October 24th issue of the New York Times, 2008, an article by Matthew L. Wald entitled, "The Energy Challenge, Nuclear Power May Be in the Early Stages of a Revival." And that's really, you know, part of today's topic, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, nuclear power, we pointed this out maybe a year and a half ago when we were over in Sandy Springs, that even one of the founders of Greenpeace now acknowledges that nuclear power is a great idea because it is essentially, I don't want to say zero emission, they call it a zero emission, but zero, you know, carbon and CO2 going up the smokestack mm-hmm. kind of thing, or at least close to it, type energy production method. So they're all for it, given issues of air pollution and global warming and things like that.
Right.
So let's actually turn to Dan. Is that basically why it's making a comeback? Because this is a nice, clean form of energy relative to coal burning and fossil fuel burning?
Those are certainly very real incentives for adopting nuclear power on a much larger scale than we do right now. It is not really fair to call it totally green, but certainly the half-life of uranium resources is much greater than what we expect from coal or certainly from what we expect from crude oil. So,
all right, you're already using big words there. When you say half-life,
cool, like
you may
crude.
Use that later. Sort of the, what is it? Normally we think of things as an exponential decay model. Is that how you're using half-life?
In fact,
when we use up half our resources.
Right.
Okay, fair enough. So that's a measure of how far into the future we can use this kind of thing.
Right.
Well, once you start with like a kilogram of uranium, what's the half-life of uranium?
But I think he's just actually talking the half-life of the use of it as a resource, right? So it's resource-motivated as much as it is pollution-motivated.
Okay.
But when you say it's not zero emission, what exactly do you mean by that, Dan?
Not zero emission. Did I say that?
Oh, no. Maybe I'm putting words in his mouth already, and we're only 9 minutes into
the show. I
said
it was not totally green from the standpoint of being totally renewable.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
But it is somewhat renewable from the standpoint of being able to recycle the uranium-238 and the plutonium-239.
mm-hmm.
I should say uranium-235. What we're concerned about is the conservation of fissile isotopes, particularly uranium-235, which is what we start with mm-hmm. in the reactors, and then plutonium-239, which grows in there from reacting with neutrons. The uranium-238 reacts with a neutron, forms plutonium-239, which is fissile. So if we recycle the plutonium as well as the uranium in spent nuclear fuel, we can extend the lifetime over which we can effectively use nuclear power on a large scale.
Right, so let me take a crack at sort of defining what are those 14 big words he used in there that is even confusing me. How are you doing, Bill? Are you surviving?
I'm doing okay, but okay. I'm not sure what crude meant, but go ahead.
Okay, so
Everything else
has nothing to do with Britney Spears.
Okay, I'll get my mind off that.
Okay, all right. Trent, do we actually got a call already?
Yeah, give me a second.
And they're complaining about the use of the word fissile, which we will define eventually.
I don't believe so. But
all right, well, what the heck? We're bold. Let's put them on the air.
Hello?
Hey, you're on the air.
Hello?
Hi.
Hey, welcome to the program. Did you have a question or comment?
I had a couple of comments. First of all, nuclear energy is very expensive, and it creates a lot of waste that's very dangerous, and Native American people who the Southern Company recently agreed not to mine nuclear uranium out in Utah near a Native American tribe, and there's better alternatives. If we could conserve the energy through home insulation and better windows and distributing light bulbs that are low-use energy light bulbs, that's another way of making energy, by conserving energy.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more, but I think the stance that we're going to be talking about later in the program is not only do we have to conserve and use solar and all these other things, but I think we're going to still be left far short given the consumption that we can live with. So I couldn't agree with you more. you know, conservation is extremely important.
Well, can I tell you one more thing?
Sure.
We're having a demonstration on April the 22nd on Earth Day to try to convince the Southern Company to invest in these alternatives that are clean, green, and environmentally friendly.
Okay.
And that's open to people who want to talk about the science of alternative energy like solar and wind energy. These things are working in Oklahoma and Denmark and Germany.
Yeah.
They can work in the United States on a wider scale.
I agree. So, I agree.
Thank you for having me on.
Okay.
Yeah, do us a favor. Are you still there?
Yeah.
Yeah, send us an email at comments@insidetheblackbox.org, and we can post a connection to that Earth Day thing, because we often do that for Earth Day on our website.
Okay, thank you for the opportunity.
Thanks for calling. So, yeah, so maybe we got to put this in perspective that, and I'm going to talk about certain colleagues of mine that are writing white paper proposals on the fact that we're going to have a huge electrical energy deficit just here in the state of Georgia in the upcoming years. That, and I don't know where you stand on this, Dan, but I'm a huge fan of solar and conservation and wind and all this stuff, but I just don't see it making up the slack in the near term.
A really good book that puts things in perspective is David McKay's book, Sustainable Energy Without the Hot Air, which you can get, you can actually download off the internet. If you just type in Sustainable Energy Without the Hot Air, McKay, M-A-C-K-A-Y, it'll go right to his webpage, and he has a free copy of it that you can download. He has a very interesting way of analyzing all these alternative energies in terms of their potential per capita.
Right.
And I would recommend that people who are interested in sustainable energy, which I certainly am, take a look at that book and form their own opinion.
Okay.
Well, I mean, one of the things that always kind of clouds the broader issue of energy is that there was an event on campus a year or so ago, and it was about energy, but everybody speaking had a vested interest in pushing coal or petroleum.
Yeah. So
or
they say the
biofuel.
Solution is whatever my research
yeah, whatever
area
I'm
is.
Doing.
That happens
you know,
all the time.
So it's a waste of time. Why even pull these people together
right.
if you're not going to – really, if you're,
that's what they do.
What's a waste of my time? I mean, yeah. if you're not going to give an unbiased – opinion, and I don't know this book at all, but if he's kind of going, okay, here's where, you know, wind would work in Oklahoma, not going to work in, you know, Georgia, the western part of Georgia near Alabama. Right. I mean, you know, it's
so. So despite the fact that other, you know, methods for generating energy are extremely important, sustainable approaches are important, green approaches are important, we're here just talking about nuclear power. Because I think most people would agree we need to exploit whatever we can.
Yeah.
Nuclear is good, as you said, Dan, because from a resource perspective, we have uranium, right?
We have lots of uranium, and we can recycle the uranium and the plutonium and substantially reduce the quantities of waste that have to be stored. So, it, you know, in terms of protecting the environment, minimizing waste production, recycle makes a lot of sense, not only in other industries, but also in the nuclear industry.
Mm-hmm. So, and
how do we, I mean, one thing that always comes up with this, and I'm not on top of the figures, but how does Europe compare with the U.S. in terms of percentage of electricity supplied by nuclear plants?
Well, France is producing about 80%. Of its electricity by nuclear power.
Yeah.
So they're a leader. Some of the other European countries are also producing significant percentages. I don't really have precise numbers.
But I mean, okay, so let's get back to this whole use of fissile and all these different elements. So if you ever hear Dan or anyone else mention an element that doesn't sound like iron or copper or carbon, these are the ones down at the bottom of the periodic table.
Mm-hmm.
They're the big nuclei. You start with a big nuclei, you put it in there, and if you take, for example, not the naturally occurring version of uranium, which is the 238 molecular mass isotope. So we've talked about isotopes before. You change the neutrons around, and you got a different isotope.
Yeah, let's back up a little bit, too. So any atom is, now I'm stepping out of bounds here a little bit, is chemically characterized by the number of protons
right.
it's got in the nucleus,
right.
and it have an equal number of electrons in the outside. So that sort of predominates. These isotopes, or you're throwing in these uncharged neutrons in the nucleus.
Right. It's still the same uranium.
Right. And at those much higher atomic numbers, it starts to become teeter towards being a little bit more unstable than nucleus.
Right.
So a slow-moving neutron coming in can break up that nucleus, release energy, and that's what's used for nuclear power.
Yeah, so 235 is less stable. It can spontaneously just break apart. Then you give off some neutrons. The neutrons get other things breaking apart. And in the end, you have this mishmash of heavy elements that are now lighter than whatever you started with, plutonium or uranium. And, in fact, if you saw, what is it? I'm a big fan of Tom Clancy novels. What was the one? Clear and Present Danger, where somebody set off a nuclear weapon. And they were able to look at the exact isotope distribution and say, that stuff came from this reactor at Oak Ridge or something like that. Because it is kind of a fingerprint the way you make these things.
Right, right.
So now, you get this mishmash of stuff, though, right, after you react this for a while, right, Dan? And you're a fan of what's called reprocessing of that material, right?
Right. So when you look at the fuel that's coming out of the reactor, about 3% of it is fission products. The rest of it is uranium and plutonium.
So by fission, you mean the U-235 or whatever it is broke into smaller elements?
Correct.
Okay.
And these are radioactive, and they cannot be fissioned again. And they are neutron poisons, which means they adsorb neutrons. So they have adverse consequences for the operation of the reactor. So in order to continue to operate the reactor, you have to take those neutron poisons out of the fuel.
So to kind of, I'm sorry, I'm just trying to educate the audience.
We're learning here, Bill.
I know, we're learning. How often does that happen?
every week.
But by neutron poison, what Dr. Tedder means is that they absorb the neutrons that you're trying to get them to go through the material and then cause more fission.
Yeah, break apart, give up more neutrons.
Right, but it's like all of a sudden, you know, acoustically having a lot of cotton in there to absorb the sound, and you've got a whole different situation. So.
Right, and if we think about burning coal or burning carbon, we take carbon and we react it with oxygen, and we get carbon dioxide. In a nuclear reactor, what happens is we have uranium, which reacts with neutrons, and the neutrons break apart the uranium. And in the process of breaking up the uranium atoms into smaller atoms, it liberates a large amount of energy.
Right, and the lowest energy nuclei happens to be what? The number, molecular weight, 55 isotope of iron. So anything above that, you know, and granted, there are little skips in this thing, depending on how you go through it. When those break apart, they give off energy. Anything below that, in general, when you squish them together, you'll get
fusion.
Yeah, that's fusion,
right?
So we do fusion on things like hydrogen, deuterium, tritium, you know, isotopes of hydrogen.
Right.
So go ahead. You were going to...
Yeah, we produce some tritium in the fission process, but we don't fuse that tritium in fission reactors. What we do, but with a fission reactor, we're burning uranium with the neutrons. Mm-hmm. And so things that consume neutrons are bad in terms of extending the efficiency of the fuel. So how often do we have to replace the fuel? Well, typically the fuel will stay in the reactor for about 4 years.
Mm-hmm.
Depends on how the reactor is operated. But at the end of that time, it would go into a cooling pool where it would be cooled off for some period of time. And then ultimately, what we would like to do is reprocess that fuel, where we dissolve it in nitric acid and chemically separate out the uranium and plutonium from the fission products. The fission products, we'd like to take that and put it into a borosilicate glass, dissolve it in the glass, place the molten glass inside of a stainless steel container, weld that shut, and let it cool off.
Mm-hmm.
And then we have something that we can store in a repository for an extended period of time.
Right. So what you're saying is you use up some of the fuel. You want to reclaim the still usable fission. Do you call that fissile material? Is that what that?
Or fertile.
Right. So something that can still undergo fission, but the fission products that are just sort of dead weight there, they're absorbing neutrons. They're diluting the whole thing. Get rid of those.
So basically get the cotton that I was talking about out of the system is right.
Right, exactly. Yeah. Get the spent fuel out of something like that.
Right. So if we have uranium and plutonium, we can take these materials, blend them together, and make what's called a mixed oxide fuel. So we have uranium oxide and plutonium oxide. If we blend them together, we can make a mixed oxide fuel.
Mm-hmm.
And then we can use the plutonium-239 as we used the uranium-235 originally in uranium oxide fuel to produce energy with a nuclear reactor. So the project that I was working on for the NRC was looking at taking warheads, which are pure plutonium metal, oxidizing them to the oxide, and then taking that plutonium oxide and mixing it with uranium oxide to make the mixed oxide pellet, which could go into the reactor. One little complication is that you do have americium that grows in from the plutonium in the warheads, and that has to be separated out before you make the mixed oxide fuel, which means that you have to go through a chemical processing step, which is what I was looking at in the process of and I was reviewing that from the standpoint of safety.
So, and it is americium, right? Not americium, like I pronounce it when I do a cheesy bit for the American Chemical Society.
Everybody I know, except for you, Pete, calls it americium.
But you know,
americium cheese. That's
I'm sticking with americium because it's a great bit about the "I like to live in America" pun on the Leonard Bernstein
americium
thing.
Americium, yeah.
I'm going to keep it. That's poetic license. That's what
whatever makes you happy.
Yeah.
But is the comedic reason? License. So what you're saying is what you're doing is you're using some of the processes they would normally do for reprocessing to actually do this weapons into plowshares. Take nuclear weapons, convert it into, you know, usable material for nuclear reactors to produce energy.
Correct.
Okay. But is the reason you're a fan of reprocessing because will that allow us to dump a lot less material in places like Yucca Mountain?
That's one important benefit, yes.
So why don't we do more of this? You talked about this last time you were on the show, that this should be one of our policies. We should reprocess a lot.
I think we should. I think what we see, for example, going on in Europe is a fair amount of reprocessing, either in Britain or in France. France is reprocessing for other countries. China is in the process of constructing a reprocessing facility. Historically, in this country, we did reprocessing at Hanford in Richland, Washington, and also at Savannah River.
Mm-hmm.
And there are still reprocessing facilities at both those locations. They're not being operated right now. And the reprocessing there was associated with the defense program.
Right, right.
Not the production of nuclear power.
But what you're saying is both sides of the aisle should like this, right? The green folks should like this because you're reducing the waste, and even the industry-minded folks should like this because you're getting the most out of your fuel. It makes sense economically.
Oh, absolutely, right.
Wow.
And also there are... if I'm, again, speaking out of school here, but there are...
That's never stopped you before, Bill.
I know. And, don't let ignorance get in your way.
Exactly. I never do.
That's my motto. But, since the Berlin Wall came down, we've been reducing the nuclear stockpile, as I understand it. So instead of just sort of leaving them out, wondering where are you going to bury them and all these other kind of things, and then you got to worry about the half-life and what's going to happen to the groundwater, convert it to usable material.
Mm-hmm. You know, if you're worried about safeguarding special nuclear materials, which uranium and plutonium fall into that category of being special nuclear materials, meaning that they could be diverted and used to manufacture weapons, if you're worried about that, you don't want to put them in Yucca Mountain.
Right.
Now, initially, you've got plenty of fission products making them highly radioactive. And so you've got the safeguards from the fission products. But after 1,000 years of storage, all you have is an occasional neutron. After 1,000 years, you could take the spent fuel, chop it up in nitric acid, and process it to separate the plutonium in a glove box with no shielding. So you have no safeguards. In other words, if you put spent fuel into a repository like Yucca Mountain, you're creating a permanent safeguards problem. So that's the second very important reason, I think, for not putting actinides into Yucca Mountain. I think we just want to put fission products there because the fission products cannot be used to make a nuclear weapon.
Mm-hmm. So
that's a good point. So if you put it in the context of the half-life, so what is the half-life of uranium?
Depends on which isotope you're talking about.
239, let's say.
Or 235, probably, because it's the fissionable.
235, okay.
I'm not sure, but it's long.
Okay. 10,000, 100,000.
Don't make me look this up on the web.
Anyway, let's say it's 100,000 years, which would be a short time span, actually, probably, for this. But you've got to be concerned about security for 100,000 years.
Well,
you know, it's hard enough to
I'm
see
not going
to
worry about security for 100,000
years. No, but I mean, to Dr. Chatter's point, that's exactly the point. I mean, if you're going to leave it there in 100 years, the safeguard infrastructure isn't there anymore. There you've got a ready access fissionable material.
Yeah, you have a plutonium mine.
Right, right.
After 1,000 years.
Right.
Wow, according to Wikipedia, 700 million years for uranium-235. That seems long to me.
I'm not going to live that long.
That seems long to me.
Regardless of how much oatmeal I eat in the morning. It's just not going
to
happen.
But in any case, I mean, so it's a good idea to, mm-hmm. to reprocess. It's a good idea to take this plutonium, do this oxide conversion, this metal oxide conversion, and turn this into nuclear fuel for what we obviously see as an energy need in this country. Mm-hmm. But it's not trivial, right? These are forget about the radioactivity. Plutonium is extremely toxic. So you need to be careful in the plants that reprocess these things, right? And that's basically what you were an independent reviewer to look at,
right?
Correct?
I was working for the Division of Fuel Cycle Safety and Safeguards within the Nuclear Regulatory Commission.
Mm-hmm.
And, the MOX plant, it's Aiken, South Carolina, is fairly unique in the sense that the Nuclear Regulatory Commission has not previously licensed a facility of the same genre. So it's a new process for them to license.
Mm-hmm.
And they need experienced chemical engineers. And I was hired in as an experienced chemical engineer who is very familiar with reprocessing chemistry and a lot of the problems that are associated with that. For example, the formation of red oil.
So what is red oil? Is this something Bill puts in his hair, or is this... What is red oil?
I may
I would not recommend that.
Sounds darn good, I can tell you. Yeah,
so. Maybe once, but I doubt you put it in there twice. Well, red oil is a product of a reaction between nitric acid and tri-N-butyl phosphate. And tri-N-butyl phosphate is a reagent that's used in solvent extraction of uranium and plutonium. So when you're operating a solvent extraction process like Purex or the MOX process over at Savannah River, you have nitric acid that's used to dissolve up the oxides, and then you have tri-N-butyl phosphate that is used to extract the plutonium away from the impurities, which in this case is primarily americium. You don't have a lot mm-hmm. of fission products associated with warheads. So one thing that can happen is if in your evaporators where you're concentrating things in the process, part of the recycle within the MOX process itself, you can have, if you have elevated temperatures in there, you can form a reaction. You have a nitration reaction basically between the tri-butyl phosphate and the nitric acid, which leads to a formation of a substance which is very poorly defined, but it's a nitrated phosphate material.
So let's define nitration.
Nitration is where you have the nitric acid attacking the other molecule.
Right, I think I see where you're going here. You'll notice that, think about explosives. If you think about explosives, what do you think of? TNT, trinitrotoluene, nitroglycerin, anything with nitro groups on it that especially is ill-defined, which usually means unstable. So are you saying this could lead to an explosion hazard?
That's the problem with it. Not a nuclear explosion.
Right.
We
right.
want to be clear. We're talking about a chemical explosion.
However, it would spew the radioactive material over whatever the blast radius was.
Well, it would have potential to do that. And
right.
And there have been chemical fires and chemical explosions at reprocessing facilities in the past. And so the design of this has to be carefully set up so that you don't form this red oil. Or if you do form the red oil, that you're sure that you take it out of the process safely and do not allow it to accumulate in places like evaporators where it can get hot and spontaneously detonate. So that's one safety issue that is important for the MOX facility.
And when you say MOX, what is that? Metal oxide? Is that what that is?
Mixed oxide.
Mixed oxide. So these are these plutonium and uranium oxide mixtures.
Right. So what they're doing, I mean, they're constructing. They have a construction authorization permit at this point, and they're building the plant. And I was that will take the plutonium oxide from warheads, process it through a tributylphosphate solvent extraction process to purify it, separate out the americium, then take the purified plutonium oxide and mix it with uranium oxide to make a mixed oxide pellet, which is then processed, placed in assemblies, and it goes back into a nuclear reactor.
And so according to this 2008 article in the Chemical Engineering, we need to take a break in just a second, and hopefully when we come back we'll talk about this. You have some very basic safety concerns about how some of this is done, and that's what we want to talk about. And maybe even some potential conflict of interest with regard to this particular process and how people accept or decline certain issues. So let's address that right after the break. Keep in mind, after the break, if you do have a question or comment for Dr. Tedder, please give us a call at the station, area code 404-894-2468. You're listening to Inside the Black Box on WREK Atlanta.
Get your weekly funk fix at WREK Atlanta 91.1 FM. The Electric Boogaloo throws it down every Thursday from 11 to midnight. Valix, L-Dog, and Treacherous are your funk doctors emeritus, and they'll even feature a guest lecture every now and then from the finest professors in groovology. You can hear all the funky grooves from the 60s, 70s, and even through today. That's the Electric Boogaloo each and every Thursday night at 11, right here on 91.1 FM, WREK Atlanta.
Listen to the bass, tap your foot to the kick, and feel the groove. If you want the most chill rhythms around, listen to Coffee and Sushi on WREK Atlanta 91.1 FM. Every Thursday night from midnight to 1, we lay down the grooves with the best in chill-out, lounge, down-tempo, and all kinds of smooth electronic music, with such influences as jazz, funk, and house. That's Coffee and Sushi on WREK Atlanta every Thursday night from midnight to 1. Tune into this week's show live by radio or online stream, or listen to a previous show right now in the archive at WREK.org.
Turned to glance at the pilot, who suddenly had both hands on his stomach and was grimacing in pain. The pilot was having a heart attack. Brian was sitting in a bush plane roaring above the northern wilderness with a pilot who was either dead or in something close to a coma. The plane came in and out of crashing, fell like a stone, and Brian braced himself for the crash. Explore new worlds. Find out what happens next by reading the book Hatchet by Gary Paulsen. For other great book ideas, visit literacy.gov. A message from the Library of Congress and the Ad Council.
Welcome back to Inside the Black Box, where we're talking with Dan Tedder, formerly of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, who's here really to address some allegations, again, that were made in an article called Weapons-Grade Allegations, published in the Chemical Engineer in the UK in 2008, that calls into question whether or not the Nuclear Regulatory Commission is exercising proper safety oversight of these mixed oxide plants, right? And these haven't been built yet, right? They're building them, they're applying to build them, correct?
They're building one in Aiken, South Carolina, which is a one-of-a-kind because it's specifically designed to process warhead material into mixed oxide fuel.
Right.
It could not be used in its present configuration to reprocess spent nuclear fuel.
And your job was to review these plans or proposals.
That is correct.
Okay.
And to look at the safety. I was in the chemical review. I was in the fuel cycle safety and safeguards division of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. And I just want to mention that there are many fine people at the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, and the comments that I make are really related to my experience with the fuel cycle safety and safeguards division and should not be extrapolated to the entire NRC. In other words, if there are safety issues with the MOX plant, for example, it doesn't follow that the nuclear power reactors are unsafe,
mm-hmm.
or that it does not follow that the NRC is not doing a good job looking at the transportation systems for spent fuel. I think that that is not a fair conclusion.
So we don't have to freak out about every nuclear reactor that's all over the country?
No. The statements
that
I'm making here have nothing to do with the safety of nuclear reactors. I would say the way the NRC has licensed the nuclear reactors, looking at the safety issues, is not directly applicable to the mixed oxide facility in Aiken, because they're very, very different. In a nuclear reactor, you're mostly concerned with a failure where you have a meltdown or partial meltdown of the fuel in the core. But there are many other events. That is not one of the events that can occur at the MOX plant.
Right, right. This is mainly a chemical
These
process.
These are chemical issues.
Yeah.
So the issues, the concerns that I have, based upon my brief tenure at the NRC, are related to issues relating to chemical safety.
Mm-hmm.
And to the boundaries which NRC places on the review process itself, which I view as somewhat arbitrary.
Mm-hmm.
For example, they do not want to review the safety of chemicals in the chemical storage area before they're actually mixed with licensed material, that is to say with radioactive material such as uranium or plutonium.
Mm-hmm.
And that causes me a great deal of angst as a professional engineer, because my training is that you want to look at the entire plant, everything, what goes in and what is coming out.
Right, right.
So the cold chemical area is an important area that safety needs to be considered, in my opinion, and should be considered by the NRC or whoever is reviewing.
Right. So are they just more concerned with things like plutonium because they're scary? But regular, plain old hydrocarbon solvents are something that, for example, the microprocessor, you know, photolithography electronics industry has to look at, because these, you know, if a giant tank of this spills over, that's bad too.
Right. So, for example, that one issue that was raised actually by Dr. Alex Murray about over 2 years ago and still has not been properly addressed by the Nuclear Regulatory Commission relates to the formation of red oil within the chemical process itself and the disposition of red oil, and whether or not the conditions that are being proposed would be safe to avoid the accumulation of red oil within the process itself, leading to the potential for a chemical explosion. Another big safety issue that Dr. Murray...
And Dr. Murray's with the NRC?
He is still with the NRC.
Okay.
Right? He is a chemical engineer, a very fine chemical engineer, a very thorough, very diligent person, and who has a long history with the fuel cycle safety and safeguards division. He has written what are called differing professional opinions. He was, in fact, the engineer in charge of the licensing activity for the CAR, which is the construction authorization request that was initially approved by NRC. But he did not sign that approval because he did not agree with that.
So what you're saying is, here's an example of engineers working for a government regulatory agency that get to behave like senior... you know, appellate court judges. They get to write the minority opinion?
Well, he is a senior chemical process engineer, which is the same category that I had when I was at NRC.
Mm-hmm.
And because he's been there longer, it's more difficult for them to get rid of Alex.
Mm-hmm.
But he was in charge. He was originally assigned to be in charge of the review of the MOX facility. He began finding problems with the chemistry of the MOX facility and issues that he felt like needed to be looked at more carefully. So he was rotated off the project.
Mm-hmm.
I was hired in to work on the MOX facility.
Right, sort of as a third-party contractor, is that your
arrangement? I was being hired as I was a full-time employee within NRC.
Okay.
I was hired because they said I was the best qualified person they could find nationally for this position.
Mm-hmm.
So I was working there to basically pick up where Alex left off, and the only problem was is that I agreed with virtually all of his concerns and his differing professional opinion.
Mm-hmm. So actually, can we talk about some of those concerns? I mean, because we've talked about this, right? And, you know, the question is, you know, were you being too stringent? And I don't think so, based on what you told me.
Back up to one other thing. So the implication here is that they moved him off the project because he wasn't giving them the answer they wanted to get. So they hired you, and they were really wanting you to give them a different opinion from what they already had. Is that...
That's my opinion, yes.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Another issue that Alex raised that I think is a very good one is in the MOX facility, they plan to use nitrogen tetroxide, N2O4. And this gas is stored in the cold chemical area in cylinders. They're proposing to have two cylinders. Each one holds about 1,000 pounds of N2O4. And one issue that was raised by Alex, I think is a very good one, is if one of those cylinders is ruptured and the N2O4 is released, is it going to go into the air intakes of the MOX facility itself? The way this facility is designed, you have airflow from the outside into the operator gallery, from the operator gallery eventually into the areas where you have radioactive materials. So you maintain a continual flow away from the operators and towards the radioactive materials, and then the airflow goes up through the
Oh, that's to treatment. Keep all the radioactive materials
right.
going toward the
right.
center, more or less.
But if you have N2O4 release and it's heavier than air,
yeah.
is it going to get into the operating area?
Right.
If it does, then it's a major problem
mm-hmm.
because... It's very toxic,
right?
And it reacts with water and forms nitric acid. And basically,
right.
You're looking, you know, what Alex called it was a death cloud, potentially.
So, but so there's nothing new here. This is what you would be worried about for any chemical lab, any chemical facilities. There's nothing to do with reprocessing nuclear weapons.
That's true.
Yeah. But toxic in the sense that it's immediately deadly, as opposed to something that if you're exposed to it. For 15 years, you might have some medical problems. So this is kind of an immediate health impact. If the N2O4 was released back into the facility, the workers there would have an immediate medical
response. Well, very immediate.
Okay. Yeah, the Occupational Safety and Health Administration doesn't really care if you're going to drop dead right away or as if you have, you know, serious health problems on the road. That's
yeah, but
just
I would.
A no-no.
I would if I was going to work there.
Yeah, yeah.
Right. I'm not coming home today or... 20 years from now.
Well, you know. So I mean, let's maybe get to the way this was handled. I mean, you talked to me before the show about you made requests that I as a chemical engineer think are very reasonable. Things like you wanted to know how they were going to avoid accumulation of, you know, potentially flammable gases, or you wanted simple things that you or I would ask any sophomore-level chemical engineer to turn in as part of even a simple homework problem or project. The mass or energy balance on these things.
That's correct. Now, that's really where I came into the picture. Now, I mean, what I was trying to do was set the stage because Alex was there before I was. And not only Dr. Murray, but other engineers, very well-qualified engineers, were having problems with management at within the fuel cycle safety and safeguards division. And several of them had written memoranda about whether or not there was a decline in the safety-conscious work environment that had occurred over the past several years, whether or not there was an ever-increasing emphasis upon program activities such as schedule and milestones. And, by the way, the managers with NRC do get bonuses, which are tied to meeting schedule and milestones.
Whoa, 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 whoa. Here's where we've got to take a break. and maybe address this, that to me, call me crazy, call me a nut job.
You're a nut job.
Thank you. But this is the regulatory agency. It's perfectly fine to put bonuses on the guy building the plant, the construction guy, because he's got to come in under budget and ahead of schedule. But you are the guys who say, look, we don't want you to do it unsafely. To me, that seems like giving bonuses to executives at Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, that they shouldn't work that way.
Bingo.
Thank you. All right. There it is.
Now,
I got a bingo.
Now, are they also at some DOE organizations, safety compliance is also part of the bonus structure? Is that not the case here?
Well, the NRC position is that the owner of the facility is ultimately responsible for the safety. So if the NRC does a review but misses things, it's not really their issue. The issue belongs to the owner, not to the NRC.
So there, it gets back to they're regulating, they're not producing. So safety at Oak Ridge would be the responsibility of the managers at Oak Ridge, and they probably have a bonus structure for safety issues. But the nuclear, mm-hmm. they're just sort of almost like like the building inspector. Once a house is built, they inspect it.
We don't expect – this is a commercial enterprise. The company that's building this facility is commercial, right?
That's true. It's a REBA.
Okay, so let's be honest here. We don't really expect – in the current environment of deregulation, I don't expect these guys to be that responsible. I think there's too much temptation to cut corners to make a profit.
But the owner of the plant
uh-huh.
is the American taxpayer.
Okay.
In other words, it's being built by private companies. It's being licensed by the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. But the owner is the American taxpayer. And that is, it's a government-owned facility at Savannah River.
So if there is a safety issue, you're right. The company that built it might get fined. They might get booted out of their interactive role in maintaining it or something like that. But, is it safe to say that the nasty liability, the multi-million-dollar lawsuit, might actually be picked up by the federal government? That's what I'm worried about.
That is true. They're the owner.
Yeah, that is exactly what David K. Johnston, a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, points out in Free Lunch. His first example is on a much less high-tech example, the railroad, that companies like CSX, who had a $56 million suit that they lost because it did not maintain switches and track, an Amtrak train crashed on that. People died. One person sued because they didn't want to accept that settlement. And in the end, they were vindicated by several levels of court cases. It was blatant. They didn't repair this switch at all. Here's the killer. Most of the $56 million, according to David K. Johnston, came from the United States taxpayers because Amtrak, which ran on the tracks, was nationalized a number of years ago. So we paid for that. There was no punitive damage to the CSX, and I worry that there's not a big punitive damage to a place like this. I think this show is really more about conflict of interest in science and technology than it is so much about science and technology.
Well, my predecessors at NRC within the Fuel Safety and Safeguards, Fuel Cycle Safety and Safeguards Division, we're arguing that the project managers within the division and the technical safety reviewers were at odds with each other because the project managers were acting as gatekeepers
mm-hmm.
and using a consensus approach in any inappropriate ways.
Okay? Mm-hmm. So wait, in appropriate ways or in inappropriate ways?
In inappropriate,
inappropriate
ways.
Inappropriate, okay.
Yeah. In other words, what they're saying is we're technical people, you're experts, we're raising issues, and you're ignoring them.
Yeah, and there's nothing wrong with raising issues. This doesn't mean you're going to shut down the plant. It means you need to figure out a protocol to address that safety issue. This happens, by the way, all the time.
Right.
This happens in all our research labs, right?
Challenger disaster in the 80s.
Right.
Was a very similar kind of situation. Mm-hmm. The engineers said, hey, there's a problem. Management above them said, we don't want to hear about this problem.
And this was the low temperature properties of rubber O-rings.
Yeah, right.
That's a really excellent example.
Yeah.
And my concern is the same type of problems are arising between the NRC and the MOX facility in Aiken, South Carolina, which, in my view, is not being properly reviewed with respect to chemical safety. There was a whole history of issues going on before I got there. Dr. Murray filed a series of differing professional opinions, which the NRC has still not responded to.
Have they released them publicly, or?
It's all public. Everything I'm talking about is available on ADAMS, which is a document retrieval system within the NRC, and also within their electric, they have their regulations and so forth. Their new reg reports are all listed within the.
Can I get that website from you?
Oh my goodness! This www.nrc.org or .gov, I think.
Good, it's easy for me to remember. All right, we'll see if we can put some of that stuff up on our website.
But, you know, like, for example, when I came along, I'm saying, okay, well, we have, here's some regulations. I look at new Reg 1718, which is on the NRC website and can be downloaded by anybody. So everything I'm talking about is out in the public domain. We're not talking about anything that's classified or anything kind of information that's restricted. It's called new Reg 1718 is called a standard review plan for the review and application for a mixed oxide MOX fuel fabrication facility, and this was something they came out with. I don't have the year right in front of me, but what the key thing is new Reg NUREG-1718, which you can use to find that. And if you look on page 8.0-2 of this NRC report. It's talking about chemical safety and the things that should be reviewed. And the very first thing they list is chemical process description, including process chemistry, process flow diagrams, mass and energy balances, inventories, major significant processing steps, safe operating limits for key parameters such as temperature and pressure, and major pieces of equipment. So when I started my review of the MOX facility with NRC, the first thing I asked for was process flow diagrams and mass and energy balances because that's just standard.
It's the first thing you write in any chemical
process. It's listed as the thing they're supposed to provide.
Right.
Well, I had already gone through their report or their application, which includes several thousands of pages of stuff. It didn't have the information. So I asked for it specifically from the people we were interacting with. They finally admitted they did not have the information I was looking for. They did provide some process flow diagrams that were incomplete, that covered parts of the process, but what I wanted was a complete integrated energy material balance analysis for the entire plant.
Yeah, see, that's frightening. I mean, that's like you, Bill, not getting the circuit diagram and the currents and the potentials, or a mechanical engineer not getting the force torque diagram on anything.
Right.
It's the first thing you do.
So it's energy, since I'm not a chemical engineer,
we
energy
won't hold
balance.
A mass balance.
You know, mass
what
balance
goes what in, chemical is, goes in, how it reacts, how it comes out.
Right. So you might have N2O4 plus
it's like your circuit
H2O.
It's like your circuit diagram.
How many molecules of whatever else you got on the other side.
And there are estimates and assumptions in here. And you can say, I don't think your conversion will really be 80%.
So basically,
but you
a
do
statement
it.
Of all potential chemical reactions.
Yeah, going in and coming out.
Going in and coming out so that everybody goes, oh, gee, this is bad. We're going to be generating carbon monoxide.
Right.
Okay.
Well, so let me cut to the chase because we've only got 5 minutes. So to me, this seems like the single most reasonable request. Were you ever asked or pressured or in some way hinted on the slide to stop asking these questions, change your report, change your view?
Yes.
Okay. Wow, I love that answer. Yes, Senator, indeed, yes is the answer.
Joe, I wonder what he meant by that.
I mean, so can you give us an example? I mean, did somebody just say, I can't accept this?
Well, I was asked to write reports of some of the meetings. I put in there comments about the applicant said they did not have the energy material balance information, and I was asked to take that out.
Oh, well, what you should have done is say, you give us that at the next meeting. We got to have that before we can proceed, right? That's not good. What do you think, Bill? No? Good?
Oh, well, I mean, I think that's a critical thing. If I described it properly, you want to know if carbon monoxide or something really toxic is potentially coming out of these reactions. To be asked to remove that from a report is
so after
scary.
Leaving, though, were you contacted by the Nuclear Regulatory Commission?
I was, after the article came out in the Chemical Engineer, I had several people came down here, and we met at Starbucks, and they were from the Office of Inspector General, which investigates wrongdoing on the part of the NRC.
Mm-hmm.
And at this point, I still have not gotten any kind of a definitive response from them. They said they would get back to me, but they haven't said anything.
Okay.
And it's been several months. I guess it was September of last year when we actually
met. Well, this is the government. I wouldn't be holding my breath. So I hope something comes of that.
It's also being investigated by a House committee, the House Committee on Energy and Commerce, which I think is being chaired by Representative Dingell.
Mm-hmm.
And
Gesundheit. Sorry, I couldn't resist.
Yeah, his daughter married Mr. Barry, so she was Dingell Barry.
Okay, we're not kidding. Again, with the cheap sophomore humor, which are...
Arrested
the middle school audience will appreciate that.
Arrested development of my sense of humor at the age of 12, but go ahead. Yeah.
All right, so we're actually coming near the end of the program. We need to wrap up. I mean, what else do we need to know about this other than the fact that I'm a bit shocked.
Well, I still am interested in reviewing the safety of the MOX process,
mm-hmm.
but I have to go in and look at it, without being fettered by what I view as artificial constraints.
Right.
Another example is what is happening to the waste that's producing by the MOX process itself. Where is it going? Mm-hmm. They do not provide definitive statements, and, NRC says, well, this is not really our problem. Once it goes off the plant site, it's not our problem. Well, you're shipping organic liquids, for example, the tributyl phosphate and the red oil that's generated is going to go off-site. Where is it going to go? Finally, talking to DOE people, I was told, well, it's going to be shipped to a company in Oak Ridge they're going to solidify it and then ship it to Nevada test site.
Oh, this is where they blow it up in the desert sort of thing, it sounds like.
I don't know.
Who knows?
Okay.
But it's a loose end.
Right.
Yeah.
That it shouldn't be just kind of left hanging.
Right. There should be an articulated plan and where it's going and how it's going to be processed.
Exactly.
It seems reasonable.
If you look at a global sense of this, you'd really like to say, okay, we looked beyond our boundaries to make sure that everything was safe. So they kind of ended up following the letter of a safety issue and then beyond that said, not my job, man. I don't know where this is going. I don't care.
So now we've reached that point in the show.
Mm-hmm.
What have we learned?
I'm not going to buy any real estate near Aiken, South Carolina. That's one thing.
I think what we've learned is...
That lake house near Aiken?
Freak out about every nuclear facility in the United States. But and maybe even this plant eventually will be extremely safe. I think the issue is conflict of interest, the kind of sort of thing that we have seen in the business world, out the wazoo. That's the technical term, out the wazoo.
The way you define that?
Sometimes rears its ugly head in science and technology.
Right.
It's just bad.
Right.
I'm going to go on the record as saying this bad.
Right. I would agree.
And specifically when someone makes requests that I think are totally reasonable, right? So you're not asking for crazy specs and all sorts of stuff. You're asking for what a sophomore-level chemical engineer would do
before
they start any process.
But in your safety class, you would have them do this kind of exercise, right?
But, I mean, we got a more rigorous going over via an EPA audit here at Georgia Tech recently about storing, a quart of chemicals, not 1,000 pounds.
Mm-hmm.
So I think this is totally reasonable, and I'm thankful for Dan for coming in the program and bringing this to light.
I appreciate the opportunity to be part of the program here at REC.
All right.
Thanks.
And please join us next week on Inside the Black Box, where we'll be talking to physicist Michael Chapman about his cryogenic work, specifically about something I know Bill is very excited about, Bose-Einstein condensates.
Put a little bit of that on your ice cream. It's really good.
I'm sure it is, with chocolate sprinkles.
Yeah.
Do you got any plugs? Are your kids doing improv anywhere?
They got a gig in a couple weeks. I'll plug at the time. But
okay. All right. I'm going to be at the Make Me Laugh comedy show this Friday at 8 o'clock at the Relapse Theater here in Midtown.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
And other than that, I just want to remind you that this is a production of WREK Studios here on the campus of the Georgia Institute of Technology. Please join us next week for Inside the Black Box, Science Only Funnier.